Accession number 9424, reel 9.
Mr. Cooper, Reel 9. You were describing your work in the Observer section, and I'd like to ask you if you could go into some sort of detail about what sort of things you observed, in particular things like shelling of the enemy trenches, and how you reported back to BHQ.
Yes, well, we did. One particular thing was reporting on if we saw any new barbed wire out. That was a very particular thing. And what movement we saw, how far away the posts were that we saw Germans perhaps getting out of or running to, and when there was shelling, sometimes we couldn't actually see where the trenches were, but we could see by their fortifications or by their movement that they were. Well, we reported in the field artillery whether the shelling was reaching the correct part by our maps, because we always had a map reading, you see, as to where the distances were. And then close up, I did recall when the intelligence officer wanted us to watch some certain posts because they were going to bombard it with Stokes trench mortars. That's very close at hand, where the trajectory goes up in the shelter. And we had to report on that, how many hits there were, and whether we thought there were any Germans still alive there.
Could you see clearly?
Oh, very clearly that, yes, because you could see them ducking, and we could see where the trench, because I suppose in reality we were only about 50 yards away, not 100 yards, 50 yards away, but perhaps further, so we could see very clearly. And the trench mortars, of course, were not very far behind the front line because they have a very short range. Did I tell you what the Stokes trench mortars look like? They just have a stand, and the shell, all they do with the shell, they drop it down this, it looks like a gun barrel, they drop it down the front of the gun barrel, and when it reaches the bottom, it hits a point of steel which sets the fuse going. And that reaches detonator, which blows it out like a shell onto the desired target. And the way they arrange it is they have a scale according to the angle of the gun, as it were, various degrees until they get the right distance. And therefore they're portable. They just, one chap carries the stand, and one chap, and probably each one carries one or two of the trench mortar shells, and another one the tripod. And they set it up just anywhere.
How long did they fire for at any one time?
Oh, not more than about 20 minutes, I shouldn't think.
And then what did they do?
Well, then they packed up and went for another target.
Were they a very effective weapon, do you think?
Oh, I think so, yes. Mind you, when I was in the front, the Germans didn't shell us with trench mortars very much, excepting during that very first attack. But the big trench mortars that the Germans used, called mine throwers or mini werfers, well, they were horrible things because they used to go up and make a puffing noise and a tremendous explosion, and they dropped right into a trench. But I never had any mini werfers. I don't know why.
To return to your work as an observer, how did you actually communicate with the trench mortar parties or the field gun batteries about the effectiveness of the
shelling? Well, funnily enough, we didn't communicate directly. We only reported to the intelligence officer, who came up to see us while it was going on. And then we told him what hits there had been. Or sometimes, it wasn't until some time afterwards in the camp, and we just described what we had seen.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what he did with the information?
No idea. You see, Tommy's in the army, didn't know very much of what went on, except on their right hand or within 10 yards of them.
Could you, whilst you're in the observer section, could you describe how your duties perhaps differed as compared to when you were in the front line in the machine gun section?
Oh, well, it was marvellous in the observer section. All we had to do is just to go up to the observation posts and observed, etc. And then when no one even told us how, we just went up, say, for the morning, and the other two went up in the afternoon, and we packed up and walked back to the canal and down into the dugout under this house. We were very much left on our own. And, of course, the Russians were there. Well, they were a bit better because we'd go out and scrounge potatoes going in the village and get straw. I don't think the Russians themselves are any more liberal. And, of course, in bed every night, all night long, never out at night. So it was really what the army called a very cushy job. And I didn't want to be disturbed, Troy.
Were there any special duties apart from actually observing that was associated with that job?
No. Certainly we had to keep our equipment clean and that sort of thing. But no, there weren't any special duties connected with it. It was a very easy job, really.
Who was your superior officer now then? Was it the intelligence
officer? The intelligence officer, yes.
How long did you stay in that particular location? You were in a bombed out house, weren't you?
Yes.
Right on the front line at this point.
Well, we stayed there. Now, when I went into the observers, I think it was about, would it be the middle of July perhaps? Well, we were in the observers until the withdrawal at the beginning of August.
Did you always stay in that house, or did you move positions
on
the
line? No, we stayed in that house until the German withdrawal came, and then we found the best observation point we could find, say, on elevated land behind the canal.
Could you describe that? How was that different?
Well, it was... just the other side of the canal, there was more a hillock leading up to Le Harissoir, which was a small district around the trees, and we just had a sort of dugout there, and one that had already been there, and we just fixed the telescope outside there.
Was that quite a long way behind the British front lines there?
No, it wasn't. No, because we watched all the all the German shelling while our troops were evacuating from Packard Wood in their own line and the stretcher bearers coming out. I don't think we did anything of great use. It was just useful to watch them withdraw and to report whether there was any German movement, how far they had gone back, whether we had seen anybody any nearer than Packard Wood, for instance.
You mentioned a German withdrawal. Did you, as an observer, see any signs of that early on? Were you aware of what was happening?
No, when we went up to to the observation post, which we had moved along instead of the house, we noticed quite a lot of movement, Germans here and there and so on. And then it was really from our own troops that we heard that they were going forward and finding all the German posts have been vacated and that they were withdrawing.
Could you explain why they had chosen to withdraw?
Yes. Is it going now? Yes, well, owing to the British attacks in the north of us, and of course, and also in the south, and even right down to the Americans who are making advances in the south, well, that meant to say if the Germans didn't withdraw, they were going to be left in the salient, and the troops would go in behind them and capture the whole division, perhaps. So that's why they withdrew, so as to straighten their line and not be left behind between the two advancing armies.
As the Germans retreated and you moved forward, could you describe what you found?
Yes, we got the impression that their morale was dropping because we found dirty old uniforms and things neglected, a general area of neglect. Of course, it's very strange for us to go into this forbidden land and find all the German signs and their black bread and so on and so forth, and some abandoned machine guns. But no dugouts, of course, but all their posts were empty. And as soon as they did start their withdrawal, and our troops, that is, our frontline troops were advancing, the big German guns at the back, not only field guns, opened a continuous bombardment on where they thought our troops were advancing. And in Packet Wood, it was the roar of shells going in every minute or so, all day long, and the stretcher parties coming out with wounded men all day. And I think BHQ got a message from one company and saying that they could hardly hold on. They were having such a terrific bombardment and so many were being killed, and they were just told, stay where you are. But I wouldn't have liked to have been in the wood at that time. It was just, you could see all this smoke from the shells going up all day long, and the stretcher men coming out with stretchers almost continuously all day.
How far forward were the British advanced by this time? Had they reached beyond the German front lines?
Oh yes, just about beyond the German front lines.
In the Observer Corps, what were your duties at this time? Were you able to look at the Germans retreating?
We weren't, no. In fact, then I thought we weren't performing much good until we were sent forward. Well, when the two of us, there were two men who were known as scouts, and they were attached to us then, and they just had to go forward and see how far the Germans had got. And that's more or less what we did in the end, just two of us crawling forward until we reached or nearly reached evidence of a German post.
And what would you do then, observe that post or go back and report?
Go back, I remember in this particular case where there was Matt Hogarth and I, we found a ditch to crawl along, and we went further and further, and then we heard this sniper firing, and we had been told by the officer of A Company that there was a sniper firing, and we got so near that we were probably only about 50 yards from his post, I should think, if that. And Matt Hogarth fired and apparently killed him because he didn't hear any more from him again. The company of A Company was very pleased about that because they'd had quite a lot of men killed.
When you were actually out there in the ditch, could you see the German yourself?
Yes.
How was he camouflaged? Was he camouflaged at all?
Well, we could only see him sort of when he came up and then down. We couldn't see him continuously. Once we had fired that shot, we crawled back.
How did you feel on that particular operation?
Well, we felt that any other Germans would have heard our shot, and they might have come forward to do us in too. But anyway, apparently we weren't seen, being low down. But we kept well out of sight in this. If we hadn't had this ditch, we'd have been seen. You see.
How far?
But one thing we did notice, that the behind the German lines, it showed far more devastation than behind ours. I mean, the shell holes were great, and any buildings were absolutely flattened. And we felt that the Germans had a far worse time from artillery bombardment than we had, because it was just wreckage, and still occasionally we'd come across a few bodies. And one case came across an officer and his batman who had lain there for some months, who were just lying together.
No German bodies?
German. No, English. And that was from April there. They were just lying there together. Possibly prisoners and being shot, as a, I don't know, but we just found them. And there was a sort of musty smell everywhere behind the German lines. Bodies of the Portuguese who had retreated in April in panic. They were still lying there.
So there was a fair amount of devastation. Did the German leave any? Did they leave any equipment, or was it just?
Oh no, they left equipment. Yes, they left. You'd see the odd machine gun and the clothes, haversacks, black bread, and things like just things that they'd thrown away. Apparently,
nothing particularly important.
No.
Right. What else did you do apart from your activities as a scout in this particular section of the action?
Well, it wasn't. We weren't there very long. It was. After all, when we discovered this withdrawal, I think it was only a matter of days before we were relieved and went back. The battalion withdrew to Sensla Valley again. And by the time we got to Sensla Valley, the civilians were already coming back. They were coming back where our front line had been, filling in trenches, and with their spades and things, were just within days. They were back. Mm-hmm.
So life was returning to normal as far as they were concerned?
As far as they were concerned, yeah.
And how did they regard the British?
No idea. We didn't even speak to them. And they didn't speak to us. But I still think they were... Well, they must have been thankful to the British from that first time when they were all retreating and they found that the Germans had never got any further than the canal and that their little villages, Le Clem and Sensla Valley, had never even been occupied or trodden on by the Germans. There was no... Well, of course, you see, no British Tommy spoke French. Mine was limited, and the people in that area probably didn't know any English at all. They're all peasants. So we just had no communication with them at all.
Did you go back into the front line, having reached Sensla Valley?
No. After that, that's when we were going out on divisional rest. And when we did that, we had all clean up, vacated our billets. Mind you, the officers were all very strict that every billet and barn and place we had been in was thoroughly clean and nothing left around. I suppose the officers who had lived in the little cottages, they had to leave it absolutely clean so that there would be no complaints or from the civilians thinking what a dirty lot we were. No. And then, of course, the day came and we all formed up and they had the battalion brass band and by companies A, B, C and D and BHQ. We all marched out of Sensla Valley with the band playing Colonel Bogey. And away we went on and lovely hot weather. And then eventually we reached this little French village. I can't remember, it was several miles behind. We couldn't hear, I think it probably about 7 or 8 miles behind the line, and we just relaxed in complete rest there in Auchy-au-Bois for quite a time.
And then you continued your journey?
Then we continued our journey, all marching. Or was it? Yes, I think it was all marching. Gradually until we reached the Arras St. Paul Road, St. Paul, and then behind Arras, and then into Arras, and occupying the old German trenches until with this big attack came September the 2nd against the Drocourt-Queant line.
Did you go?
Before we move on to describing the Arras front, could you explain what you did in divisional rest and how long it lasted for?
Yes. Well, we didn't do anything. We kind of just complete rest. I think it was about 2 weeks.
Where were you billeted?
Well, we were just in the barns of local farms.
Were there any entertainments laid on, or what sort of atmosphere existed there?
No, I don't. We weren't near any town. It was just, of course, to us, it was simply marvellous to be there with no sound of guns, no sound of machine guns, complete tranquility. And we just used to, of course, I had my friends there, we just used to go walks and so on. We might have done things that I'd forgotten all about, but I don't think I mentioned in my writing that what we did. I can put in a little. We probably did have some sports and everything, but I can't recollect what we did really.
Can you remember the name of the village that you were in?
Auchy-au-Bois. It was not much more than a scattering of farms. There were no shops or anything in it, which of course to us, we didn't mind. It was such a complete change. It was like being in another world after being in the sound of guns for April, May, June, July, for 4 months, and never seeing a civilian, and never even behind the British guns. Even when we were on rest, the 6-inch guns and 9.2s behind the village used to all their shells rushed over our heads. Even then, so you can imagine what it was like to go in complete tranquility to a lovely little village with orchards, etc., hens clucking around and the cock crying in the morning, just getting up from having nothing to do. Except we had to keep smart, and as far as I recollect, we'd have some occasional parades to see everybody, and perhaps a bit of physical training, but otherwise just left on our own, and we were there about 2 weeks. Then we set off marching from there towards ours. We probably marched about 30 miles altogether.
When did you first learn that you were going to go to Arras?
We were never told until we just got near there. And then even then we didn't know why we were going or what was going to happen.
Did you just go there on foot, or did you travel by
train? Oh no, all on foot. And we go through these, tramp through these little dead villages in the dead of night. And we'd always go. They always had some billet ahead, some old empty house they didn't have church, or just some old empty houses or barns that we could always lie down in for the night.
How many days did it take you to get to the Arras front?
I can't recall exactly, but I should think it took the best part of a week. Marching. We marched sometimes during the day and very often at night, because it was very hot then, you see. It was August, mid-August, that we were doing all that marching.
And
do you know, in those days, there was no such thing as walking in your shirt sleeve. We kept on the same clothes in winter as in summer. Even in that August, we had long woolen johns, long johns made of wool. We had our thick wool vests, flannel shirts, and khaki thick serge, well, it wasn't serge, thick cloth khaki, and our putties around our legs.
Did people suffer from heat exhaustion as a result of marching with full kit?
No, we were hardy then, you see. But why we didn't have summer clothing at all, it was unknown, summer clothing. Well, I remember when I was a little boy, we didn't change much in the summer.
Did you think the heat affected you personally?
No.
Were you able to keep up with the march rate?
Yes. Mind you, we got very tired and a bit exhausted when we fell out about every half hour to the side of the road. We weren't allowed to drink, of course, because that's the worst thing you can do when you're on the march. But if there was any brook or ditch, we used to roll our sleeves up and put our arms in the water right up to our elbows for several minutes. That was very reviving. And of course, we didn't eat on the march either. We weren't allowed to eat or drink.
How many hours would the march last for?
Perhaps 2 hours.
Per day?
Maybe more. Oh no, I can't really remember how long, but we did some quite long marches. I think we did about 15 miles or so.
When you reached the Arras front, can you describe what happened to you there?
Yes, well, when we reached the front, we came across all the well-known lines, Monchy-le-Preux, and that Arras front, you know, had hardly changed in 4 years. Very desolate. All the ground, just shell holes almost touching each other, and old trenches, old German trenches. Then, of course, when the British trenches, they're all dug down in chalk, and you go down steps. You go down 20 steps to the bottom, which, of course, we had never seen, because you couldn't dig dugouts on the Lebowski front because of the water and the mud that had come. But that was a wonderful experience to go there. And our billets were in either old in British or vacated German trenches down in the dugouts.
And then so you didn't actually, you weren't actually behind the lines when you were in your billet?
Oh, we were behind the lines, yes, because they had advanced. I should think where we were in these billets, I should think we were probably 2 miles behind where the British had advanced to.
I see, but in the old trench line.
In the old trench line. We did, I know we had, by the trenches we were in, sometimes there'd be a battery of field artillery firing their guns, because that was, they carried 2 or 3 miles, you see, to the German lines. But completely, we didn't have any shelling, or we were outside machine gun range, just completely desolate.
Yes, no tree cover? Or
no tree cover at all, no. No attack.
Right, if we might stay with the new trench system that you come across,
yes,
at Arras, for, and describe that, for example. You say it was very much deeper than the trenches that you've been in.
Oh, yes, they were at least 5 feet deep, cut through the solid chalk, and of course, every so often there were these dugouts you could go into, down 20 steps, so you can... If there was any shelling, which there wasn't, but of course, as you can imagine, there had been, when that particular part of the front was active, you could be in complete safety down these steps and have a good night's rest until you came up for duty during the night or during the day.
Yes, what accommodation was there in the dugouts?
Well, there were just bunks of wire netting. Well, it looked like, excepting there was no mattress or bedclothes, and it was just this wire netting. But if everyone had a blanket with you, you could put a blanket over you, and there was no electric light. It was just we had our candles to light the place. But I was going to speak about later when we came to the German dugouts later on. They're very much better, all lined with wood panelling, etc.
If we might just stay British lines at the moment. What about the maintenance and repair of these trenches? Did you have to do
them? They didn't really need any maintenance. They would last forever, actually. They cut through the chalk.
Were they well drained? Did they have duct boards at the bottom?
They didn't. No, not the one. No, because the rain, of course, percolates very soon through the chalk, so it didn't have duct boards or wet trenches at all. And one interesting part to us was we were in these trenches, we were just forward of a hillock called Monchy-le-Preux, which was a very, very notable place. It had been fought for and retaken by the Germans and the British for years. The main reason was because it had terrific view from over the whole area. Anyone who held Monchy could see the enemy trenches right back to well beyond the reserve line and beyond that. Therefore, that's why it was fought for so much. Completely destroyed, just the desolation of houses and slates, etc. And that was interesting to me, because the old sweats up when we were on the Labassi line always used to talk about Monchy-le-Preux and about, oh, you should see the deep dugouts and trenches at Arras and so on. So it was quite an eye-opener to come and actually see them after we'd all heard them talked about.
Did you go up to Monchy-le-Preux?
Yeah, just on a sort of scrounge round, and you'd find, still find parts of the skeletons there, and